Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll cut through the noise with interviews, insight, and answers from people who make decisions. Coming up. The big economic calls that will define 2026 inside the Government of National Unity room where South Africa's political power shifted, our accelerating online gambling crisis, and from hijackings to hashtags, the moments that really moved South Africa in 2025. It's Friday, the 19th of December. Now, after a year dominated by political shocks, tariff threats, and wild policy swings out of Washington, investors are asking a simple question. What does 2026 look like? Now, according to some forecasts, the U.S. economy could land in the so-called Goldilocks zone, not too hot, not too cold, with steady growth, easing inflation, and gradual rate cuts. But with Donald Trump in the White House, stretched valuations and big unknowns around artificial intelligence, labor markets and interest rates, I guess that balance could easily tip. So let's make a little bit of sense about what is going to be arguably a very tough 2026. Isaac Udendal from Old Mutual is with us. He's been a guest on our program before. Isaac, let's start with that Goldilocks year for 2026. Why are markets talking about that? What's driving that conversation?
Yeah, it's essentially the combination, as you said, of, you know, inflation hopefully declining. Obviously, it's kind of around 3% at the moment, but sort of steadily declining through the year. Growth remaining resilient, as has been the case in 2025, despite, you know, the tariff shocks and so on. The AI capex boom continuing, and you know, the labor market in the U.S., although the unemployment rate has ticked up a little bit, it remains very low. And so you put all those things together and you say, well, perhaps it's essentially a continuation of what you saw this year. And I think also as we head towards the midterm elections in November, I think many investors are saying Trump is probably going to behave a bit more, you know, and will not try to do anything extreme as we saw in April this year. And in fact, what he might try and do is sort of give consumers a bit more relief on the tariffs, perhaps even send out some checks or some sort of fiscal stimulus. So you put all those things together and you say, well, you know, it's perhaps the outlook is fine, you know, and it's very much like it is at the moment.
But notwithstanding that, though, Donald Trump still remains surely a market risk. Or are you suggesting maybe that he might just become a sideshow, that markets, investors have factored in the inconsistencies that keep coming thick and fast?
Well, that is the risk, of course. And that's exactly what we saw earlier this year, is where you know, in the first few months of Trump's presidency, there was sort of, I suppose, like you call it complacency or, you know, attitudes were quite relaxed around what he was going to do. And then boom, in April, you know, he slams with all these tariffs. So that might still happen. But as I said, I think, you know, you've got the election now looming towards the end of the year. We've already seen sort of splits within the party. You've seen Republican politicians more able, you know, more willing to stand up to Trump. And I think that kind of combination says perhaps he's not going to do anything extreme and risk losing the election in November. He can do anything, but...
Of course he can, yeah. It's like, how central is the U.S. economy to global market direction at this point? I'm thinking of other major players like China, for instance.
Look, the U.S. will always be very important. Ian, if you just look at global equity benchmarks, the U.S. is sitting at sort of two-thirds of market cap weighted of a global equity benchmark. The dollar is obviously the dominant currency in the world. You know, that might change over time, but where we stand today, you know, if the U.S. sneezes, it's definitely, you know, the rest of us getting sick from a financial markets point of view. Now, what can happen, of course, is something like the dollar could continue easing. That's actually good news for the rest of the world. You know, we want a weaker dollar. So that won't necessarily upset the apple cart. However, if there is a big correction on the S&P 500, for instance, on the New York Stock Exchange, you know, we are going to feel it in other markets around the world.
What would a too cold U.S. economy actually look like for investors?
Yeah, so I think the big risk, if you say, you know, we're not going to get Goldilocks, but instead we get sort of downside growth risk. Mm. I think, you know, we saw, as I said earlier, you saw the unemployment rate has been picking up a little bit. The problem is normally when it starts rising, it keeps rising. You know, it doesn't just stop. So that would be the big risk, is that you see in the U.S. labor market, you know, people are struggling to find work as it is. You know, companies are, I think, reluctant to hire given the uncertainty, but perhaps also because they are experimenting with AI. You're not seeing many job openings in the U.S. anymore. And I think so that's really the big risk, is that the labor market deteriorates. Obviously, if people can't find work, if people lose their jobs, that impacts spending, and then it kind of cascades, because then the next person's job is at risk. So that's the big risk. I think I would, on the downside, is that the labor market deteriorates quite dramatically in the next couple of months.
Isaac, let me pick you up on the AI investment comment that you've just made. What role is AI investment going to play in tipping the balance either way? Because it's becoming increasingly used and increasingly important, right?
Yeah. So I think the fact that there is this AI investment boom means that downside risks are probably limited. It's very hard to see the US falling into recession when there's all this money being spent on AI. It's not necessarily that labor intensive. So you could still see quite a weak labor market. You could still see the unemployment rate rise a little bit. But ultimately, I think as long as the spending continues, the US economy will be chugging along. The question obviously then is, you know, what happens if it stops one day? What happens if one day we wake up and companies decide that they've been overdoing it, or that, you know, there's a cheaper Chinese alternative, you know, DeepSeek or whatever, and we don't need to build all these data centers? That's a different matter. Mm. But I think, you know, in the foreseeable future, you know, the checks have been signed and the spending will continue for at least the next couple of quarters.
And for South African investors then in 2026, what matters more? Is it growth? Is it rates? Or, as you've suggested, the dollar?
I think it's actually all of the above. But what we don't want to see in South Africa is, we obviously don't want to see U.S. interest rates sort of having upward trajectory. You know, not that I think the Fed will hike this year, but I think if there's inflationary pressure, you could start seeing some of the long end bond yields starting to rise. You know, and then you are talking about a stronger dollar, which in turn means a weaker rand, and possibly the Reserve Bank then goes on pause. So I think that is not a helpful scenario for us. By the same token, if it goes too cold, you know, yes, the Fed will cut, and that is probably going to be dollar negative. But by the same token, you could see market anxiety. And as we know, you know, the rand tends to not fare that well when there's global angst on markets. So, yeah, I think as South African investors, we also want the Goldilocks picture to continue in 2026. With the caveat that I think at least for a change, we are kind of helping ourselves a bit more. And the more that we can improve the functioning of our economy and improve our infrastructure and so on, you know, the more insulated we become from potential global crosswinds.
And talking about helping ourselves, a final question. Our annual inflation softening in November, and that's edging a little closer to that new 3% target from the central bank.
Yeah, if you just look at the last couple of days, you look at today's inflation print, you look at where the rand is trading, about 1674, where the oil price is trading, just below $60 a barrel. You know, and I think not many people were expecting a January rate cut from the Reserve Bank, but I think that is now on the table. If you look at the good news we've had the last couple of days, so that would obviously be a very nice start to the year for South African consumers if we get that January rate cut.
And I look forward to talking to you in 2026 from Old Mutual. Isaac Odendaal, appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up to date stories.
Now, South Africa's political landscape was transformed in the aftermath of the May election in 2024, when the ANC, as you know, failed to secure a majority for the first time in three decades. And that thrust this country into high-stakes negotiations that produced, as you know, the Government of National Unity. Now, in Inside the Deal, the talks that shaped South Africa's future, award-winning journalist Mandy Wiener takes readers behind the closed doors. And it is, for my money, the best political book of 2025. If you're looking to buy something for Christmas, here is something to get hold of. Mandy, a very warm welcome. And as a political journalist, how quickly did it dawn on you that that election result wasn't just a shift in numbers, but a fundamental break in how this country was governed?
Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah, I think it was the morning after the results started coming in. I think we already knew that it was going to be some kind of a seismic shift, that it was going to change the landscape of politics in South Africa from this monolithic ANC that had a majority for 30 years to something vastly different, and that we were going to have to find a new way to govern in the country. It took me a little longer to work out that I wanted to write a book about it, and that was because for that period of 14 days and then the full period of 30 days until a cabinet was announced, I realized that everything was taking place behind closed doors. None of us in the media were privy to what was going on. We were reliant on sources and leaks. And I was curious. I wanted to know what was going on in Inanda, what was going on in the hotels in Cape Town. We didn't know at that stage that the Enthoven's home in Westcliff was one of the key sites of negotiations. But I wanted to know what was going on inside those rooms. And that's what made me ultimately write the book.
I want to get to the Ramaphosa interview in just a moment, but in that time that you're describing, how leaky was the bucket? Were people talking?
Yeah, there was a lot of manipulation of the media that was taking place at the time. So the bucket was leaky. It was selectively leaky. And you'll remember there was that period with all the letters that were being exchanged as well. So it was deliberately leaky. You know, the letters were being made public through the media. Everybody denied that, of course, saying, oh, it wasn't us. It must have been the other side. But we, of course, know exactly who leaked it to us. But I think that because these negotiations were happening in smoky rooms and in the dark, really, for that reason, we were so reliant on the leaks and on various narratives to try and explain to the public what was going on.
I hate using this trope, but I'm going to do it anyway because we're at the end of the year. But we were in, at that point, uncharted territory. When you were analyzing this, did you think the system would hold, or was there a sense that we were heading into real political danger?
I did not know. I was always pretty confident that the center would hold. And I think that's because we fundamentally actually have good people running the country. We're very quick to criticize the government and how dysfunctional it is and service delivery. But when you reflect on it now, you realize that for everybody that was negotiating, and keep in mind, we probably had about 30 people negotiating in total on behalf of 62 million South Africans. I think that those people genuinely had the best interests of the country at heart, and they wanted stability. They didn't want lawlessness. And of course, looming over all of this was the threat of KwaZulu-Natal, comments made by former President Jacob Zuma, potential for unrest like we saw in the July unrest. So there was the potential for things to fall off the edge. And also we have this bizarre requirement in legislation that gives our lawmakers 14 days to form a government, which is not very long if you look at what's happening in Belgium or in Germany or wherever else it may be. So I think that what our leaders actually achieved was pretty phenomenal.
Let's go back to the process of writing the book itself. Can you describe how you eventually secured an interview with President Ramaphosa? If I understand this correctly, it almost didn't happen.
It almost didn't happen. It was begging, pleading.
Cajoling, yeah.
Cajoling. It was sending a message to Vincent Magwenya, the president's spokesperson, almost every day saying it has to happen. Please, I can't do a record of history without it happening. And the book was done, completely done. It had been through an edit. It had been through a final edit, and I got a message from Vincent Magwenya one night saying, tomorrow morning 11 o'clock at the foundation, it's the only time I can get you. So you never believe these things until they actually happen, but I was at the foundation. The president walked in. He sat down across from me and he gave me about 80 minutes, which I was very surprised by. And I think he enjoyed every minute of it because he was reminiscing and he was full of anecdotes and regaling me with the stories. I think he quite enjoyed this period. And he was quite deliberate in what he was saying about the Democratic Alliance and John Steenhuisen. But that almost didn't happen. And I thought it was essential that it happen for a record of history, for this to be the real record of what happened over this period, because Ramaphosa was the one that was the architect of this government of national unity. He was the one pulling the strings for all the parties. So it was really necessary to have his perspective, his take.
How do you assess then the relationship between Ramaphosa and John Steenhuisen, and how crucial was that to the eventual outcome?
It depends who you ask, right? John Steenhuisen says that he believes that it was the discussions between himself and Ramaphosa that ultimately got the deal over the line. When there was deadlock between the two parties, that it was their meeting at Mahlamba Ndlovu which ultimately got this deal to get this deadlock over cabinet positions to ease. It's interesting, Ramaphosa was very deliberate, as I say, about what he felt about John Steenhuisen. And he said that meeting where John Steenhuisen brought a bottle of wine to a Nick and Forties epicenter to Ramaphosa was a mellowing moment. And Ramaphosa spoke about his relationship with Rolf Meyer and how he didn't feel that his relationship with John Steenhuisen had quite the same magic as his relationship with Rolf. And he said that he didn't have the same degree of trust with Steenhuisen, that he could have a conversation with Steenhuisen and he'd go and tweet or go and tell the DA all the details. So I got the sense from Ramaphosa that he felt that John Steenhuisen wasn't necessarily running the show at the DA, that Helen Zille actually was. And this alludes to the two centers of power that is so concerning within the DA. But Ramaphosa was clear about what he thought about Steenhuisen and about Zille.
Just a final one, full circle, quick answer. As we come back then, or as we start to approach 2026, what do you see as the most significant test then for this coalition government? And Mandy, do you think it's going to endure?
I do think it will endure. I've said consistently, even through the budget standoff, even through the issues around Andrew Whitfield and other bailable concerns and all of that, I believe it will endure because the alternative is too terrifying to contemplate for both the DA and the ANC. So I think the big test is going to be local government elections next year, either late next year or early 2027. And I think that is going to be a concern because at municipal level, things are going to get really ugly. There's going to be a lot of horse trading, a lot of negotiating. But I think ultimately the GNU as we have it in government will endure until the next election, next national elections. The ANC sees this as a temporary measure, that it is a strategic step, and they believe that they will win a majority again. I don't believe that. I think that we are very much in coalition country, and our politicians are going to have to find a better way to negotiate deals going forward.
The book is called Inside the Deal, The Talks That Shaped South Africa's Future. The author is award-winning journalist Mandy Wiener.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
As South Africa heads into the festive season, the National Gambling Board is sounding the alarm over a surge in illegal online gambling. It's warning that financially stressed households are being aggressively targeted by unlawful operators. With December a high-risk period for gambling harm, the board is urging consumers to avoid illegal platforms and seek early help. Joining us now is Lungile Dukwana, who's Acting Chief Executive Officer of the National Gambling Board. Lungile, a very warm welcome to you. How bad is the situation in your opinion?
No, Jeremy, thank you for the opportunity. Well, we would say that the situation is bad in the sense that we are approaching December, the festive season. I think people would have got their bonuses. People would have got their savings from the stock fells and all of those kinds of things. So what we are basically doing is to say that whilst you will be having those resources you need to have for your family to enjoy with them during the festive season, we must avoid gambling irresponsibly for those who are actually gambling. That amount that you're actually getting is for your family, is for your loved ones, and to make sure that you progress as an individual. So we are basically saying that they must avoid gambling where they gamble with on the illegal platforms, because the big challenge is also the illegal platforms that are being used. Those illegal platforms lack safeguards. They lack responsible gambling requirements that we have put in place. And you are not certain whether you're going to get your win, even if you actually win. So the warning is basically about that.
Right. So you talk about illegal online gambling, which has exploded, and we know this despite repeated warnings. I've got to ask you why you think regulation hasn't kept pace with the scale of the problem.
Well, I think that the phenomenon of the regulation of the online gambling is not just a South African phenomenon. I think broadly, there is a lot of illegal gambling that is online, even in countries that they have made good progress on it. But I think that South African situation is unique in the sense that the legislation we have is quite old. I think it's a 2004 legislation. And we know that the department is actually making efforts, has released a paper where now we are looking at the issue of the online gambling as to how it should be. I think there are engagements currently at the various levels, including on the forum of the PLAs, where we are looking at the issue of the online paper that should be coming out for public comments or for engagement to the public. So there is progress on that side.
Right.
But what we should not take away, Jeremy, is that we have a legislation now, and that legislation is the 2004 one, and it prohibits online gambling except for sports betting. And that is the act that we're implementing currently. Anybody who's doing something else is acting illegally.
Legislation is one thing, but you'll agree with me that many illegal sites look indistinguishable from licensed operators. And surely, Lungile, that's a sign that enforcement has fallen behind technology.
Well, in terms of enforcement, Jeremy, yes, I think that there's a room for improvement there. But I think that the work that we've been doing jointly with the PLAs has been quite a lot. We did raids, I think, recently in the last 2 months or so. We did about 5 raids in the various provinces, some in Limpopo, some in the other areas as well, where we discovered that there were illegal online that was actually happening, or illegal physical shops that were actually happening. And we think that the most important thing is to make sure where we pick them up, we do report, and we're able to close those and seize the equipment that they're using there and open the relevant cases for that kind of work. So we are doing that kind of work, and we are happy with the progress that we are making this far. So enforcement will remain one of the most important aspects. In fact, as the NGP, what we're working towards now, we will be revealing a program where we're saying we must gamble responsibly and gamble in South Africa. So in that sense, we're meaning that you must avoid gambling in the illegal website. You must avoid gambling where it is not a South African website. It must be local and it must be legal, so that we can retain all of that money in South Africa. We can contribute to the issues surrounding the responsible gambling.
But part of the problem is online casinos are illegal, yet South Africans are still seeing their ads openly on social media and WhatsApp every single day. There's the problem.
We have on the 1st of December, Jeremy, we issued a directive, I think, to the PLA, the provinces, who are the licensees. And we said that we are now cracking down on the advertisement. And those advertisement is a various kind of advertisement. But specifically, where you are advertising something you are not licensed for, we are taking it down. Where you are not, you are advertising where there are kids that are not supposed to be the target of your adverts, we're taking it down. So there is work that we're doing with them. They will be reporting to us almost on a monthly basis in terms of the work that is being done there. So advertisement and those messages, we have also taken it further and said, the public, where they see those billboards that are being advertised, they must report them to us. Where they are getting messages that are unsolicited, that are coming from these illegal illegal gambling sites, they must actually send them to us. And then we're going to be able to be acting on those particular areas. So we are stepping up in relation to the enforcement and making sure that we deal with the issue of the advertisement, because that issue cannot be acceptable in the kind of society that we want to create.
Just a final question then. At what point, in your opinion, or have we reached that point already where problem gambling stops being a personal responsibility issue and now becomes a public health crisis?
Well, look, the problem gambling is a personal responsibility issue that we can't take away. But once it requires you to be accessing health services and all the other related issues, it becomes a public health issue. Where we are now, we are doing various studies, I think, in terms of the problem gambling. I think the previous study that we did was in 2024, which gave us a certain figure of the problem gambling. So in that instance, one of the aspects we discovered was that some of the people who are actually gambling were enticed by some of the advertisements that are actually coming up. So in that particular instance, it means that we have a role to play in terms of making sure that it does not become a public health crisis.
And I think I've got room for just one more question. Have you crunched the numbers? How much revenue is South Africa losing because of illegal operators who are there almost in plain sight?
Well, the challenge we have with that figure, Jeremy, we don't have the figure as NGP. Because the challenge is that the illegal gambling website, by their nature, they're illegal and they are not operating in the open, even with their own financials. So we cannot be able to monitor that in a sense. We can only monitor, for example, the illegal, the unlawful winnings, which we deal with the banking institutions. For example, if you gambled with a site that is in Germany, what is going to happen is that we would be interacting, for example, with the South African Reserve Bank and the other banking sectors, and you will have to surrender those winnings to us. Then we do an investigation. Then we determine whether it's an unlawful. So in that specific instance, we are beefing up. I think that we have a few memorandums of understanding that we have signed with the banking industry, including SABRIC, and they were working on the one with the Reserve Bank. So we cannot have a definite figure at this particular stage.
I'm going to leave it there. I'm sure we'll talk again in 2026. That's Lungile Dukwana, who's the Acting Chief Executive Officer of the National Gambling Board. Lungile, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, from crime and corruption to protest movements and political theatre, I don't need to tell you that 2025 has been a year that has left many of us angry, exhausted, and deeply online. Now, Acumen Media's Year in Review pulls back the curtain on what truly moved the country, not just the headlines, but the stories that ignited outrage, mobilized movements, and exposed national pain. So, what does South Africa's digital pulse really tell us about who we've become and maybe who we are or where we are heading in 2026? In that respect, I'm in conversation with Tanya Curry, Media Director at Acumen Media. Tanya, a very warm welcome. As far as South Africa's emotional landscape is concerned in 2025, is there a single story that dominated?
Well, no, there isn't a single story that dominated, but there are single stories in categories that have dominated. So, for example, if we had to talk about GBV, we had several stories there that really were highlighted throughout 2025, namely the State Bear story and also this purple profile adjustment that we've been doing on our timelines, specifically around the G20, to bring to light the massive femicide, GBV, child rape, child killing rates that are happening in South Africa. And I think that was one of the massive stories all year. Of course, it was, you know, we found Jocelyn Smith in amongst that same category, and where we saw people like Judge Erasmus really bring our national pride to the fore. Like, here we found somebody that we could really hold on to, and he did the right thing. So, yeah, from GBV, that was a very big theme. Politics, just huge. Political killings, the Madlanga Commission, the Shamila Batoy story. You name it, we've been through it. So, Kat Matlala and Kenny Kunene. We can produce a Glynis Breytenbach and a Kat Matlala, Jeremy, all in 1 year.
So quite an exhaustive list. So let's go back to the GBV issue, if we can, very quickly. Online movements that emerged like hashtag Women for Change, how powerful do you think they have become in 2025?
I think it was absolutely incredible what Women for Change did in 2025. I know a lot of people said that they'd hijacked the G20, but they've been going a long time before that. They were perhaps opportunistic with the G20. And it worked to a certain degree where the president actually stood up and called it a disaster, did he, or a crisis? I mean, again, a lot of talk. We haven't seen a lot of action. And, you know, this is a narrative that we've seen in South Africa for years. But I think from an awareness campaign internationally, I think Women for Change made a massive impact at the G20. I think international visitors saw for the first time that we do have some serious problems in South Africa, and it's not all about farm murders.
Let's go back to the Madlanga Commission. Is there a sense from your analysis that in any way it changed public either belief or perception in the justice system in South Africa?
Well, I think when Mkhwanazi came out and said that the SAPS was captured, none of us were surprised. But I do think when when these commissions take place, the same with the Zondo Commission, it's very powerful watching these incredibly strong attorneys and politicians clawing at for the truth. It's very impressive. And I think we saw that again in the Madlanga Commission. I think we saw it even more in the Ad Hoc Parliamentary Committee, which unfortunately ran out of money, didn't it? But that there we saw like stellar leadership. And it makes you wonder, Jeremy, you know, when we see again, like with state capture, all these powerful voices for so-called good, we aren't voting them into parliament. You know, they each come from a different political party. I mean, you had, for example, Darlene James, amazing, and Matthijs from EFF, incredible. But they're all with different, Glynis Breytenbach, all with different parties, where we have this great leadership. It's almost so disappointing for us. We have this great leadership, but that we can't find cohesion amongst it, that we can vote for somebody.
Tanya, let me ask you this. Do you have a sense, again, from your analysis, how dangerous misinformation has become in shaping our national identity? And I'm also wondering whether social media is maybe amplifying trauma a little faster than we can actually process it.
I think you're quite right. I mean, the days of us waiting for a reaction is long gone. I mean, you take the Tete story. I mean, within seconds, the whole country was protesting. That image of a little girl crying was everywhere. It was almost as if it was a marketing exercise. It was just, the branding was just unbelievable. And yes, that is social media. So social media has given us the power to pick things up so quickly that you can't hide anymore. And I mean, one of the biggest stories where that's prevalent is the Epstein files. You know, there we're seeing a lot of social media pushback on certain stories, and you know, we're able to see there are very definitely two sides of the stories, and you can't always buy the one that you're being fed by the narrative. And I think that's put news media under pressure this year. You know, we've had some news media houses also being the focal point of, did you get that story right? Because we do look to news media as some way of accrediting whatever it is we're reading.
Just a final one. In terms of what South Africans are scared of, I presume that crime has eclipsed load shedding as our number one fear.
Absolutely. We fixed load shedding ourselves for the most part as South Africans. You know, we were left to it. We were left in the dark, and we literally picked up the baton and did it ourselves. But crime, political crime, is just off the charts. And I think we're also fearful that there's no leadership, Jeremy. You know, like Cyril Ramaphosa comes out in the data as one of the most hated people in South Africa. You know, and where to now for our country? You know, the local election's coming up, and who is the new ANC possible incumbent? Is it Toko Didize, or is it Fikile Mbalula? Like, and how do we feel about those two names on their own? And will the ANC even get even 20% in the next election? So I think we're fearful politically and also from a crime statistic, yes.
Well, there's no doubt that 2026 is shaping up to be a very interesting year. Media Director at Acumen Media, Tanya Curry, thank you very much indeed. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day and the year. We're back on the 5th of January, 2026.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.